My name is Jack. I'm an alcoholic. And it's not about me. Good job, Samantha. My story is just like hers, only a lot longer. My sobriety date is March 4th of 2014, which is the day that I checked in at Winmore, which is a luxury hotel on alternate 19, for those who can't quit drinking. I was 57 years old when I checked in. I'm 68 now. I've been sober, haven't had a drink for a little over 10 years. Be 11 years in March. I have a BA. I have an MBA. I'm a CPA. Impressed? Didn't impress anybody, and I'm an AA. And believe me, I learned a lot more in AA than I did with any of those other acronyms that I have. And I only tell you that because it doesn't matter who you are, what you are, how much you know, or who you know, or where you go. If you got the disease, you got the disease, then there's not much you can do about it. Or at least I couldn't. I didn't even realize I had it until I was probably 40, in my 40s. And then I thought I might have it. I was drinking a lot, I knew that, but I wasn't sure. I thought I might have to do something about that. I've been married 3 times and divorced 3 times. The last time I was divorced was in sobriety. But let me tell you about my first drink. I think I was 10 years old, maybe 11. My parents had a bar in the basement. They used to have parties down there every so often. And I was curious about how that whiskey tasted, so I went down there one afternoon when we were on summer break and took a shot of whiskey. I mean, I did it like my dad did. I gulped the whole thing down to see how it would taste, and it burned going down. I went across the street. We had a baseball diamond across the street from our house to play baseball, and I could not do anything. I mean, I was drunk on one shot, and I thought to myself, this stuff is not for me. And I didn't have another drink again until I was probably 17 or 18 years old. Even though I had some friends who drank, I wasn't interested in doing that. I was interested in getting everything I could get. And by that I mean I wanted to be the best in everything I did. I wanted to make the most money of anybody, any of my friends. I wanted to have the nicest car, the biggest house, and all that stuff. And that was my aim and end in life. I was good. I mean, I did a lot of things great. I was a four-letter varsity athlete in high school. I was the valedictorian of my high school class. I was pretty damn smart. I went to college, and I got mostly A's and B's, and I graduated from college and went to work. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to get to work so I could make some money. I got married when I was 20. I was a junior in college. My wife worked the last 2 years, put me through the last 2 years of college. She quit working as soon as I started working because she wanted to have kids, and I don't blame her. And we did have. We had two daughters. I had two daughters in my first marriage. So I started working when I was 22. I'm 68 now, and I'm still working. When I was about 29, I was going to retire when I was 40 because I had my plans made, and I was going to make a lot of money, enough so that I could sit on the beach and clip coupons and not have to worry about anything at all for the rest of my life. That didn't work. My plans did not pan out. So along the way, I really started drinking when I shouldn't drink, when I was about 24 or so. I worked for a public accounting firm, and one of the things that you had to do in a public accounting firm back in, this is in the 60s now, they didn't frown upon drinking at lunch. As a matter of fact, they encouraged you to take your clients out to lunch, entertain them, and bring in new customers, new clients. I was good at that because they bought my drinks. They gave me an expense account. It was free. I loved it. whatever sporting events I wanted to go to. All I had to do was tell them I'm taking a client, and there I was. So when I was 25, I learned how to abuse my employer's expense accounts. I didn't think I was abusing their accounts. They offered it to me. So I might take my buddies to the game, or I might take someone I shouldn't be with to the game because I was married. But that was okay because I was working. I was doing my job. So, and what happened to me was my drinking kind of snuck up on me. I was, I'd drink at lunch, take a client out to lunch during the week, maybe have one, two, and if the client would have three, I'd have three. If he had a four, I'd have four, and I used to pick the clients that I knew drank a lot so that I wouldn't feel bad about drinking as much as I was drinking. So, and then I would go back to work, and of course I was 100% functional when I got back to work for the afternoon, although at least that's what I thought. Obviously, you know that you're not when you've had that kind of alcohol consumption in that short a period of time, because that would probably be an hour. Four drinks in an hour probably would make me illegal, would be my guess. So that was how it started, and then I worked in downtown Detroit then. I'm originally from the Detroit area, and we had this awful traffic problem at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and I just hated to fight that traffic going home, so I'd wait till the traffic cleared, and I wouldn't wait in my office and work. I'd wait in the bar with a few other guys. So, I'd have my two or three at lunch, and then I'd have three or four or so after work. But I switched to beer after work, so I wouldn't get too drunk. Lunchtime was, cocktail time. After work was beer time. So, but that was okay because I wasn't the only one doing it. Everybody around me was doing it. I hung around with the guys who did that. I wasn't doing anything out of the ordinary. I got to be about, I was 29 years old. And the kicker is, I'm not getting punished for doing this. I'm getting promoted for doing this. I'm advancing along I'm moving up the ladder ahead of most of the other guys because I'm bringing in new customers. They love that stuff. So why change? I didn't realize that I was an alcoholic, and it was just getting progressively worse. I got to the point, I was probably 30 or 31, a friend of mine and I, another CPA, decided we wanted to find a business that was a cash business so we didn't have to pay Uncle Sam the share that he takes. And we found this plot of land. We were going to open a Dairy Queen. We tried to buy it. The deal fell through, and we asked the guy that was looking for a business for us to find us something, and he did. And he found us the perfect business. I bet you know what it is. It was a bar. Now, this friend of mine and I, we used to both drink J&B. That was our drink of choice. We'd have meetings discussing the business and how we were going to run it and operate it. And the meeting would last an hour or two or three, as long as the court of J&B lasted, and then the meeting was over. But what happened was, I was very successful in this bar business. We made a lot of money. I had more money than I ever dreamed I would have at that age. I was 31 years old. I was making more than the partners in my CPA firm were making on my bar business. And I still held the job with the CPA firm. So I was working full-time there, and I wouldn't call it work at the bar. I was having fun. But what I have to tell you is that when the Dairy Queen deal fell through, and we found the bar, I went home and asked my wife if it was okay with her if we bought a bar instead. And she said, no, absolutely not. And, I asked. But I did it anyway. And the reason I did it in my mind was so that my kids would have everything they needed. They'd have the best clothes. They'd live in the nicest house. They would be they'd have everything that was the best. And the real reason was I wanted the damn thing. I wanted it because I wanted to go out and I wanted to have a party. That was the reason I did it. I did everything I wanted to do when I wanted to do it, regardless of what my wife or my kids wanted. It didn't make any difference. It was all about me. That's why I said it's not about me in the beginning. because I don't want it to be about me. It's all about, we're all like that, at least the ones that I know. It's all about us. I mean, actually, we're just doing what we want to do. We just make rationalizations, excuses for doing what it is that we know is wrong, but we're going to do it anyway. I did that for a long time. So I ended up divorcing. Well, you know, when you're in the bar business and you're an owner, everybody wants to know the owner, especially the young, cute girls, the single ones that, you know, they don't really care that you're married. So I ended up doing a lot of that kind of stuff, which in my mind was okay. I don't know how I rationalized that one, but I justified it. The girls didn't care. They didn't care if I was married. So anyway, there were countless of those types of encounters. So anyway, there was one woman that I ended up, one of the ladies I was seeing, I fell in love with. At least I thought I fell in love with her. And I told my wife I wanted a divorce after we'd been married for 17 years. My children were 10 and 13. I had no clue how devastating that would be to my daughters for me to just up and leave. They're 41 and 45 now. I think they might have forgiven me by now. I'm not sure about that. I don't think that they've told me all the hurt that they went through when I left. But the point is that I left because my rationalization for that one was that my wife did not keep the house clean enough. I came home after working two jobs during the day, and I had to walk through dirty laundry, dirty dishes in the sink, and I just couldn't put up with that. I mean, that was my head. That was the reason that I decided it was okay for me to leave after 17 years. And I rationalized that my kids would see more of me because they never saw me the way it was. I was always working or drinking or partying or going out doing what I felt like doing. I rationalized I'd see them because I'd have scheduled visiting times and days, and I'd see them with quality time. I'd spend quality time with them for a day or two on a weekend for the whole day. And you know what happened? Something always came up when I was my scheduled time. I might see them for 3 or 4 hours on a weekend. I was supposed to see them for 2 days. I was too busy. There was too much other stuff going on. So I didn't see him. But once again, I was just telling myself that so I could justify in my head it was okay to do what I was doing. What I really wanted to do is I wanted to get out and be with this woman that I was so madly in love with. So I married her, and then she divorced my ass because I was really starting to drink then. I mean, the drinking had gotten to the point where now I was drinking in the morning. I'd get up before I went to work, and she and I ended up working together. I'd have to have a shot or two before I left. And I had a bottle in my desk drawer. I had a Corvette. I had a nice fancy Corvette. I had a bottle of J&B in my Corvette. It would kept rolling around in the back. You know, those Corvettes don't have any place you can lodge the bottle. So I built a little box to shove it in. I mean, I literally built a handy box to put my bottle of J&B in, so I'd always have something with me. Never got pulled over for a DUI. Never got a ticket. I thought I was pretty damn lucky. The honest truth was I was extremely unlucky because I got away with it. I got away with everything, at least so I thought. It seemed like the worse I was, the better I landed. When my second wife divorced me, I obviously had to move out of the house. No place to live, really. One of my friends, a female friend who was married, let me move in with her and her husband. And she said to me, after I'd been there for like 6 months, she said, "You know, you're like a little kid. We never know when you're going to come home. You come home at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, you wake the dog up, you wake the baby up, you're going to have to leave." But she said to me, she says, "You're okay, Jack, because you always land on your feet." And I did again. I found another lady that I had become acquainted with, had a condo, and she was moving out with another friend, and I moved into that place. It was a one-bedroom spot, and this condo was 2 miles from where my daughters lived. I was drinking all day then. I was to the point where it was morning till, well, when I was conscious, I was drinking. And I passed out. I didn't go to sleep. But my kids lived 2 miles away, and I never went to see them. And I didn't go see them because I didn't want them to see me as drunk as I was. And I couldn't stay sober long enough to go see them. I mean, I lived there for almost 2 years. Didn't see them once. So, do I feel guilty about that? You're absolutely right, I do. You know, it says, we'll not regret the past. I do regret that. Those were big mistakes that I made. So, at this point in my life, all I did was drink. I didn't care if I woke up the next morning. I was 42. I think I was 42 or 43 years old, and it didn't matter to me if I woke up the next day. I was kind of hoping that I didn't, because then I wouldn't have to keep going through all this stuff. But I met another woman at a bar, at her birthday party. She was a sister that was married to a good friend of mine, and for some reason or other, she liked me. I don't know why, because I was pretty much drunk while I was talking to her, but I was moving to Florida. I met her on a Friday night, and I was leaving to come here on a Saturday because I was living in this condo. It was the middle of winter. I was tired of the ice and snow in my car, and I just had to get the hell out of there. So I packed up everything I owned, put it in the trunk of my car, and drove to Florida the next day. But then I kept in touch with this woman, and 4 months later, we got married. She came down to see me in Florida. And I don't know why she said, you know, if you make me an offer I can't refuse, I might have to think about it. And we were both drunk. I got down on my knees and I asked her to marry me. And she said yes. Now, I had moved to Florida working for an ex-client of mine who had moved his business down here. I was making 30 grand a year. Now, that doesn't mean a whole lot, but in context, my wife was making, the woman I married was making 60 grand a year at the time, and she quit her job in Michigan to move to live with me, making 30 grand. She didn't have the good sense to ask me if I could support her or not. And I really didn't think much of it, to be honest with you. I just thought, okay, we'll get through it. And we did. We ended up getting through it. Once again, I got back on my feet, even though I never stopped drinking. I ended up working for this company, and I ended up becoming a vice president of the company, making a lot of money again, still drinking, still no consequences or none that bothered me. Then they fired me. The guy that I worked for, that I had gone through the business and built the business up with, left, and they hired a new guy. And this new guy, he didn't like the fact that I smelled like alcohol all day. And neither did most of the people that worked with me like the fact that I smelled like alcohol all day or acted like an asshole most of the time. Because I was vice president, and I could tell you what to do. So they fired me. That should have been my crushing blow. That should have been the clue that said, hey, you better stop drinking. Well, it wasn't. This company was going to close one of their plants that was back up in Michigan, and I knew they were going to close it. And I said, no, don't close that. Let me buy it. Now, I got a hold of a couple of guys that I knew had some money, and I said, I got this great deal up in Michigan. You want to invest in it? We can make some money on it. And they did, and so we bought that business, and I became the president of that business. I ran that business. I moved. I kept my condo in Florida that I had bought. I moved back up to Michigan, bought another condo. This was back in the day when they didn't check your credit. I swear to God, I called a bank at 10 o'clock one morning, and at 1 o'clock I was approved. I mean, I didn't have a job. I don't know how the hell they could approve me, but they did. So I bought this condo. We ended up keeping some customers from this business, and we made some money. But what I did was I got up there and scouted the area out to make sure we picked the prime location to live so it was close to work. What I really wanted to do was pick a prime location that was between work and a liquor, there was a liquor store between work and where I lived, so that I could stop there, and it had to open at 7 o'clock so I could stop there in the morning on the way in. And I just kept drinking every day. I mean, it was awful. We had the business for a year. We made pretty good money. But my employees did not like working for me because when they did something that I thought they did wrong, I was not a nice boss. I got angry, and I would throw stuff. My missile of choice was a telephone. We used to keep spare telephones in there because I would throw it, and if it didn't break on the first throw, I'd keep throwing it until the damn thing broke. So what happened was, and it's funny, my wife and I talked about it and said, well, thank God you got a business now that you own, you can't get fired. Well, that was wrong. The employees got together and called my partner, who happened to be my brother-in-law, and said, this guy is drinking all day. We've got customers calling us, telling us that he smells like booze. Something's got to be done. If you don't do something about it, we're leaving. Now, we had 42 employees, and all 42 of them were in agreement. They signed a letter saying that they were going to leave. So he called me up one Saturday and said, can you meet me? I got to talk to you about something. And of course, we met in the bar because he was a drinker too. I mean, he was no slouch when it came to drinking. And he said, I don't know how I can talk to you about this. It's kind of like, you know, kind of like the pot calling the kettle black. I mean, he said, are you drinking? And I said, what do you mean, am I drinking? He said, are you drinking during the day? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, how much do you drink? And I lied to him. I don't remember what I told him. But I said, yeah, but I drink during the day. He said, well, the people called me, and they're going to quit unless you stop. Well, you know what I did? I did. I told him, I'll stop. And if I can't stay stopped, if I can't, then you can have the business, and I'll just go about my way. But I stayed stopped for maybe three months. I did not drink a drop. But I couldn't keep it up. I mean, I didn't go to AA, I didn't seek any help, didn't seek any advice, I just stopped. But then I started drinking again, and well, what happened was, I was back drinking for about 2 weeks, and they called him again and said he's drinking again, and that was it. I was done. Walked away from a business that was making money, but that was strike two. Well, I probably had a lot of strikes before that, but I didn't count those, so it was... So that was my big strike, too. I mean, I was almost out. So what happened was, lost that job, and we had some money. I mean, I'd saved some money up by then because I was, you know, we were making money. So I had a little cash, and, you know, I wanted to go back to work and find a job, but I couldn't find anything because I couldn't stop drinking long enough to go on an interview. And, you know, it gets kind of tough when I was probably 50 or so at that point in time in my life. And so I called a friend of mine, one of my very best friends, who was a pretty wealthy guy, and he had a lot of business contacts. I told him that I had a drinking problem, but that I had it under control, that I wasn't drinking, and asked him if he could find me someone that could hire, needed someone like me to work for him. Well, he did. He found a good client of his, and I ended up working for that guy and made a lot of money again for another 9 months. Until my drinking caught up with me again, the guy that owned the company came into the office one day, and I was sitting at my desk asleep. And he said to me, he said, you know, a couple of our clients have said that you smell like booze on the job. And I said, well, it must be from the night before. And, you know, I was still drinking every day in the morning, and they fired me. So kind of screwed over my buddy. Because I told him I didn't have a problem, and he thought it was okay. He vouched for me to get the job, and I blew it. Although I did a good job while I was conscious, but that wasn't all the time. So now there I was. It was now I was out of a job, and it was really, that was kind of like strike three. So I should have been done. I should have been out. And I kind of was. We moved back to Florida, sold the condo we had in Michigan, and came back here, and I was drinking pretty bad. My wife said, you know, you're depressed all the time. You need to go see a shrink about your depression. I wasn't depressed. I drank a quart of vodka a day. That will depress the hell out of anybody. I mean, that's a depressant. So I went and saw this shrink for like 4 or 5 months, and the shrink's taking my $120 a week or whatever she was taking. Never once asked me if I drank. I mean, I had to reek of this stuff. She gives me medication for depression. So I don't know if it relieved my depression or not. I was too drunk to know whether I was depressed or not. So, but to make a long story short, that obviously wasn't my problem. My problem was I was drinking too much and wasn't willing to admit it. I mean, if I had half a brain, I would have said to the lady, I'm drinking too much. What can you do to help me? I didn't want to get help. I guess I didn't tell you part of my story was that the first bar went so well, I opened a second bar. A bigger, better bar, a 2,000-seat concert hall. We had the likes of Bob Seger and Hall & Oates and Ted Nugent and those kind of acts in there, and it was just great. I mean, I got to meet all those guys. I didn't do the dope they did, but I loved to watch them do it because they did all kinds of stupid shit when they did that stuff. We had Iggy Pop. I don't know if you know who Iggy Pop is. He might be. Anyway, Iggy Pop came out there. He came out on stage, and he had been doing something back in the dressing room, completely naked, with his privates tucked between his legs, and he was walking forward like this, and he went through. He did one song, and then he turned around and bent over, and then he left. That was the end of his act. But that was the kind of lifestyle that I was getting used to, and I was liking it. It was fun. It was like, you know, it was crazy. Absolutely crazy. And I just did it. I put up with it. We had the guy that's called Sting now that was with the police. He came in there, and he was just like, he was an absolute maniac. But it was okay. It was fun. It was like, you know, it was a high for me. So anyway, I get back to Florida, and now I'm looking for a job. The money's starting to run out. I'm back in Florida, and I can't find a job. I've got the best resume that you could ever lay eyes on. BA, MBA, CPA, I've been the president, the vice president. I've owned my own company. This guy is, Jesus, he can do anything. And I got a lot of interviews, but I couldn't get hired because I couldn't stop drinking long enough to get the smell out of my body to have a decent interview. I mean, I reeked of alcohol. I got offered one job, and it was for a position, and I turned it down because it wasn't enough money. I mean, that's how crazy it was. I needed a job, and I turned an offer down because it wasn't enough. And I really didn't want to stop drinking. I was, you know, it was like, you know, 70 grand, I need 100. If it was 100, maybe I'd, you know, it's worth stopping drinking, but you know, 70, no, I'm going to keep drinking. I mean, that was the logic that went through my head. Because if I get a job, I'm going to have to probably stop drinking. So, anyway, my wife finally found me a job. She was sitting on the couch one day, and she was going through the St. Pete Times, and she said, I got a job for you. I'm pretty sure they'll take it. Well, you know how they used to run the ads in the paper for paper boys? For delivery boys, that's what she found. And I went down there and interviewed for it, and I got it. I got the job. I had to be there at midnight every night for the papers to get there, and I had to deliver 330 papers a night. And for that, and this was 7 days a week, and those Sunday papers, they weigh, I'm not sure, 5-6 pounds a piece. And on Thanksgiving, that's the whopper. Well, I had tennis elbow in both elbows. I was still drinking all night. I was delivering papers in Safety Harbor where they didn't, on the north side of Safety Harbor, which is the old side, it didn't have street lights on all the streets. I was running into bushes. I mean, I was knocking over mailboxes. It was just pathetic. I was the worst delivery boy in the distribution center. Every day I would miss at least 15 customers, and they didn't fire me, and they wouldn't fire me because nobody else wanted that route. And it was like, I'm locked. I mean, I'm solid in here, and I was making like $220 a week is what I was making. I mean, it paid for my gas, it paid for the repairs to my car, But, you know, we weren't getting anywhere. I mean, going nowhere fast with that one. So, but, you know, and I still didn't realize that I had to stop drinking, that I had a problem with drinking too much. I mean, it was like, it's okay. I mean, I got a job. I'm doing all right. And everybody was patting me on the back. Good for you. You had to do something. You're out. You're doing what you had. And they're telling me, good for you. And I'm like, if you only knew, I mean, how bad I was. So during this period of time, I got my annual physical, and I was 54 or 55 now. At my annual physical, my doctor, he said your liver enzymes are elevated in your blood count. I felt a lump in your stomach. Your blood pressure is a little high, and you're borderline diabetic. And I thought, okay, tell me the bad news. But he said, I'm going to send you for a liver scan. And I went for a liver scan, and the results, when I got the results, he said, you have a mild case of cirrhosis. He said, mild case of cirrhosis. And that was what I heard him say. I didn't hear him say cirrhosis, and I didn't remember looking at the pictures of the guys that were yellow, and, you know, their eyes were yellow, their skin was yellow, you know, they couldn't walk. I heard mild. And what that meant to me was I can keep drinking for a little while longer because I'm not too bad. 15 left? Okay. This is where I get the resentment, Joe? No. Anyway, so I kept drinking. I mean, I kept drinking. I came back 2 months later or whenever it was to be retested, and he said, okay, now it's worse than mild. It's bad. He said, what can I do? I was looking for a medicine. I was looking for medication. I was looking for a diet that I could go on. You know, what kind of foods can I eat? And he said, no, the only solution is that you have to stop drinking. And I said, okay. And I tried, but I couldn't. I couldn't stop. I went back to him, and a week or 10 days later, and I said, I can't stop. He gave me Anabuse, which is, you know, you might have known what that is. And Anabuse is a drug that makes you violently ill if you take it and drink on it. I took it every day for over a month, and I drank every day, and I never got violently ill. I swear to God, it was like, what is going on here? I would take the pill in front of my wife in the morning so she knew I was taking it. My routine was that I would get up in the morning, I would take a shower, I'd shave, I'd get my hair cleaned up, I'd put a suit on, and I'd go out looking for a job. And what I did was I went straight to the liquor store and I bought a bottle and I drove from parking lot to parking lot and I drank and passed out and drank and passed out and came home at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and said, honey, I'm sorry, I can't find anything again today. And I did that every day, Monday through Friday. I didn't care. So I got home one night and I hadn't been sick, and my routine was when I got home, I'd change my clothes, I'd go lay on the living room floor with my dog. I had a Pomeranian and play with the dog for a while, and then I'd get up and go pass out. Well, this one night I got home and I tried to get up. I couldn't get up. I kept falling over. I couldn't stand up. Just kept falling down. My heart was pounding out of my chest. I thought finally I'm going to die from this disease. But obviously I didn't, and made it upstairs. And I came back down the next morning. My wife was gone. She had taken all the money she could find, all the bottles she could find, taken the keys to both the cars and left the Yellow Pages open to rehabs and left me a note. And it said that if you're here when I get back, I'm leaving you. I can't take this anymore. Now, mind you, that we'd been married for 12 years, and I was stone alcoholic the whole 12 years. I don't know how she ever lasted as long as she did. But for some reason, she did. And for some reason, I picked the phone up and I called Winmore. And I talked to the guy for like an hour and a half, and he was telling me what the place was like. And the real kicker was how much it was. They wanted $12,000 for 28 days. And I said, you're out of your mind. I mean, who would pay that kind of money to get sober? I mean, not me, certainly not me. So he talked me into going into a dual addiction unit they have there, which is a lockdown unit. He said, we'll call your dual addiction will be depression and alcoholism. And I said, okay, when can I come? And he said, you can come right now. We got beds open. And this is a I think it was a Saturday morning, might have been a Sunday morning, I'm really not sure about that. So I said, all right, I'll be there. And then I hung the phone up and I realized I didn't have a way to get there because my wife was gone, she had the car keys, I didn't have a ride. I thought about calling a cab and then stiffing him when I got there, but, you know, I thought, no, I just didn't want to do that. And so I said, I'm just going to have to ask a neighbor for a ride. So I went across the street to ask some neighbors of ours that had become very good friends of ours if you could take me to the rehab. And as I'm walking across the street, I am trying to come up with a lie that he would buy as to why I have to go to a rehab on a weekend morning. And I couldn't come up with one. I couldn't come up with a lie that even I would buy. So I told him the truth. I said, I have a problem with alcohol. And he just got this big smile on his face and he said, oh, thank God, you're finally, and I'm like, what? You know, obviously everybody knew because, I mean, I was that bad. I asked him, well, how did you know? And he said, well, that's your bottle right over there in my bushes, isn't it? I used to go for walks at night, and I used to hide bottles in my neighbor's bushes so that as I'm going for my walk, I'd get my drinks and then stick the, you know, I didn't think anybody knew the bottle was there. And, you know, it's like, but that, you know, that's where my head was. I mean, I was, when you talk about obsession, that is one thought to the exclusion of all others. And that's exactly what I was. I was obsessed with the thought of having alcohol and probably even more obsessed with the thought of not having it. I don't know what the hell I would have done without it. I mean, there were times when I can recall throwing stuff around in the house looking for a bottle that had something in it when my wife wasn't there. I was psychotic. But I had a BA and an MBA and a CPA, and I was vice president and president of a company. But nonetheless, I had alcoholism, and I had no way of getting rid of it. So I came into the rehab, and when I got to rehab, one of the things they ask you a series of questions, one of which is, how much do you drink? And I told her I drank a pint a day. And, you know, I'm lying in a rehab. And I'm in an alcohol rehab for alcoholism, and I'm lying about how much I drink. And she, because the insurance Winmore would accept insurance if you went up to this other unit, if you went to the dual addiction unit. So I said, that's the reason I agreed to come. And she came back and she said, they're not going to allow you to be admitted because they don't think your problem is severe enough. And she said, are you telling me the truth? I think she might have heard this before. And I said, no, it's more like a quarter day, which was still a lie, but it was more. You know, I upped the ante. And she said, well, I think that'll work. And she got me in. And it was really scary because they take your blood pressure and they take your vitals before they send you up to your room. And my blood pressure was 185 over 135. I felt pretty normal. I mean, and there was the scurrying going on around the admissions office, and they were, you know, sticking an IV in me, and like, you know, how you feeling? Are you feeling? I feel fine. But I was ready to pop, and I didn't even know it. I mean, I probably could have popped at any point in time. I had no clue how bad I was. I got into rehab, and there were a lot of things that I heard that I learned. I was in the detox section of it. Up on the third floor, which is the lockdown, which is really neat. The guy says you can't have any, you know, you can't wear shoes with laces, you can't have any belts or, you know, check your razor blade at the door and no lighters and all that kind of stuff. I mean, you know, and there were anybody and everybody, if they were eligible for Medicaid, they were in there. That's where they came to dry out for a month before they went back out and got high again. But it was pretty scary, and needless to say, I was anxious to get the hell out of there. So after like 6 days, I learned a lot. I was ready. I was ready to go, man. I knew I had it down. I didn't know anything about the big book or the steps or any of that stuff, but I knew what alcohol can and did do to my body and would continue to do if I kept drinking it, and that scared me. So my wife came down to meet me after 6 days. And I said, I'm ready to come home. And she said, well, I'm not ready for you to come home. Because she'd been in touch with the guy who ran the place, and he thought that I should stay a little longer. So I was another 30 days, and it was that 12 grand again. And I just didn't want to pay it. I mean, I was like, you know what? I don't care. Leave me. I'm not paying $12,000 to stay in here for 30 days. I'm just not going to do it. Not to mention I didn't have it, but I had an American Express gold card. I mean, I swear to God, I had an American Express gold card that was an unlimited credit. But I didn't want to use that because then I had to pay that back, and that's all I could think. It was just crazy, the stuff that went through my head, all the reasons I was coming up with for not going in there. So my wife said to me, I'm going to call your friend, my best friend in the world, the one who got me the job in Detroit that I screwed over when I kept drinking. She called him and said, will you loan him the money? And he said, if you think that'll fix him, I'll loan him the money. And he did. He owed me $12,000. I did pay him back. But when you think about that, I mean, I screwed this guy over with what I had done to him before. You give 12 grand to an alcoholic and your chances of getting it back are not good. But he gave it to me. He saved my life. My wife saved my life. My best friend saved my life. And Winmore saved my life. God saved my life. One of the thing that I remember hearing, the first thing that I remember hearing vividly was my counselor who was in Winmore said, I kept saying, I don't know why I have this need to drink all the time. And she said to me, have you asked for help? I said, well, yeah, I've asked for help. I asked a doctor for help. I didn't understand what she was saying. And she said, no, have you asked God for help? And I said, no. Why would I mean, I really, honest to God, I mean, I'm a pretty intelligent guy, and the thought never crossed my mind to ask God or any spiritual or higher power for help. And she said, well, why don't you do that? And I did. And she said, I'm Catholic, and I was an altar boy. I mean, I know the Confiteor. Christ, I mean, I knew all kinds of prayers. I said lots of prayers. Our Father's Hail Marys, you know, when you go to confession and the priest says, for your penance you shall. And I said all kinds of those prayers, but I wasn't praying to be forgiven. I was praying so I could go to communion the next day so my parents wouldn't yell at me. That was what it was about for me. But I asked for help. And I won't say that my desire to drink was lifted right away, but over the next couple of weeks, it was. I mean, honestly, literally was lifted from me. I didn't have that. I didn't feel like I had to drink when I left there. So I'm not sure if that's what got me to the point where I didn't feel like I had to have a drink. I'm not sure. I don't know. And I really don't want to find out at this point, because I still do that. I still do that every day. I mean, I still get on my knees and I still say my prayers, which includes keeping me away from a thought about drinking or any of the things that go along with alcoholism, because I have all those too. You know, I wasn't just a drinker. I was a bigamist. I guess I was almost a bigamist. My second marriage, I got married the day after my first marriage. The divorce papers were signed. My second wife didn't realize it was that close, but that's what happened. But the things that I did that I attribute to the fact that I'm an alcoholic, which doesn't justify it, it's just that, I mean, the messing around with other women, the lying, the cheating, the stealing. I mean, I stole money from people, and I didn't even have to. I had some money, and I still stole money from people. I went into a grocery store on a Sunday morning once, and they had the liquor on the shelves in the grocery store, and I took a pint of vodka, and I stuck it down the front of my pants. I had a pocket full of money, and I started to walk out of the store with it. I don't know why. I didn't want to spend the $2 on the pint of rot gut that I was buying. I have no clue why I did that. That's just the way I thought. I'll save it for when I have to pay for a drink, is probably what I was thinking. So while I was in rehab, I still did not have a job. I was looking for a job. I couldn't find work while I was in rehab, and We talk about the promises happening. You stick around till the promises, till you see them happen. I was in a rehab, and there were seven of us. We called ourselves the Seven Doors because we felt like we were in Disney World. There was nobody there to hurt us. There was a young lady there who had a fiancé who owned a car dealership in Wachula, Florida, and he was the person who managed his money. The controller of the store was not doing a good job. They were trying to find a replacement. She told him about him. She told him about me. He came in and interviewed me in the rehab center in Winmore, and he hired me. I swear to God, he hired me to manage his money. I'm an alcohol. I'm sober, 4 weeks maybe? He hired me to manage his money. So it was, he said, well, you got to talk to my partner first to confirm it. So I went to meet his partner 2 days later. His partner said, yeah, if he thinks you're good, then I think you're good. And we never even told his partner where he met me. And he said, well, how do you know Mike? And he said, well, I know him through his fiance. And that was all, I didn't lie. I just didn't tell the whole truth. And he said, well, how much do you want? And I said, I want 60 grand, which is, a reasonable pay. And he said, well, we can't pay you 60. He said, well, we're paying the girl that's there now 72, so we got to pay you at least 72. I mean, I swear to God, it was like, I had a job. The guy's going to pay me more than I was asking for. Like, what's going on here? But the real benefit to me was that it was in Wachula, Florida. I lived in Clearwater. Now, Wachula is 2.5 hours from Clearwater. And I had to carpool down there. I left my house at 5 o'clock in the morning. We carpooled down to Wachula. We got there at about 7:30 or 8. We left there at 5, carpooled back, got back at 7 o'clock. I went to a meeting, and I came home, and I went to bed. I didn't have a car while I was there, so I couldn't go out and have lunch or do whatever else that I felt like I might have to do. It was perfect. I mean, it was perfect for me. I was there for 2 years. We got the place back to normal, cash, money-wise. I got a call from a headhunter, and she wanted to know if I wanted to take a job with AutoNation, which is one of the big car dealerships up here in this area. And I don't know where she got my name, how she got my name, and I said, well, yeah, I'll come interview for it. And I did, and the guy that I interviewed with went to the same college I did. He lived two streets away from me when I was going to college. And he said, oh, yeah, you're in. You're in. And I didn't even ask him how much the job paid. But I was going to be 10 miles from home now. And I was, I was sober over a year. I mean, damn near a year and a half since I'd even had the thought of a drink. And they paid me $96,000 at this new job. I mean, I swear to God, it was like, I'm not even looking for this stuff. Now, money's good to have. I mean, but that's not the best part. I mean, the best part is that I don't have to drink anymore. I had the educational, I'm having the educational variety of a spiritual awakening. I've been reborn several times. It says on one of the pages in there, 62 or so, they read it as the beginner's promises, and it says at the very end of that section on page 63 that we were reborn. There are a lot of things that we benefit, that we benefit by following the advice that is there in the first 164 pages of the big book and in the 12 steps. We get a chance. I got a new chance. I got another chance at life. If I had written a book about how I would want it to end, I wouldn't have written in that I was going to be divorced for the third time. I wouldn't have written in that I was going to be living in a single room in a deaf assisted living facility, which is where I am. I wouldn't have written in that I would have let my wife take all the assets we had when I got divorced. But that's what I did. And I don't know why I did that. I was thinking the other night, I tell people that I gave my wife everything, my third wife, everything. We had by this time, I had bought a house in Arizona. I owned it. Half of that should have been mine. And I keep telling, and I'm telling everybody I gave it to my wife. I didn't give her shit. She earned it. I mean, she earned every cent of it. I mean, I put her through pure hell for the 12 years I was drinking. And then I'm still selfish. I'm still self-centered. I still think of myself all the time. I'll tell you that it's not about me, but I'm the only thing I can think about when it comes. I mean, regardless of what the circumstance is, the flash is always there. How does that impact me? When I'm mad at somebody for doing something or when I'm afraid, it's because I'm thinking about me and how it's going to affect me. I have days where I don't get mad. People do things that normally would upset me, and I don't get mad. And that's when I'm not in myself. The only way I get there, there's two ways. One is that I pray and pray and pray, and I remember that God does love me. I'm still here. So, and he must want me to do something because I'm still here. And I think about all the stuff that I have. You know, I tell my sponsees, they call and they have a problem. And they start telling me about the problem. And I'll let them finish telling me about the problem. Then I'll say, well, what are you grateful for? Just stop what you're doing now, hang the phone up, and go back and just make a list of five things you're grateful for. And then call me back. And if you do that, and if I do that, the problem that is so centered in my mind goes away. Or it starts to go away anyway. Because I think about what I'm grateful for. And you know, they say a grateful alcoholic won't drink. And a grateful person won't be irritable, restless, irritable, and discontent. I mean, if you are grateful. And it's easy to be grateful for, I mean, for me, it's easy to be grateful for what I have. I don't have as much as I used to have materially. I don't have any of that stuff. But I have a car that I can drive. I have a job that I go to. I get to work at a rehab center on the weekends, and I see people that are just like me, that are young and struggling and trying to lick the problem they have. And they're just like I am, just like I used to be. And I see that, and I get irritated with them because they don't get it. You know, they don't get it yet, and I want them to get it. I want them to get it right now. I want them to understand right now this, what you're whining about is not important. Stop whining about that stuff. And that's what I did. I whined about the things I couldn't get. I couldn't have when I wanted them. It ain't worth it. I'm 68 years old now, luckily. I'm not sure how much longer I'm going to live, but I hope it's sober. And you guys that are in here young, getting a jump start on this stuff, take it from me, it does not get any better. I'm sure you've heard that before, but I am living proof. I went through it. I tried to make it better, and it just got worse. It didn't matter how much alcohol I put in me, it wasn't enough. It just wasn't enough in the end. Thank you.